Accession number 18191, Reel 6.
Okay. So a special trial was set up to try and find out what might have happened and to establish that the aeroplane was in fact absolutely safe. At ministry levels, they were very scared of this special trial and were really certain they were going to lose another victor. They were just convinced of this. And because of it, they thought it was highly dangerous to have anybody in any of the rear crew seats because they didn't have ejection seats to escape in a hurry. So it was decided to modify the front end of the aeroplane that was chosen to do this trial by putting the air electronics officers' panels, these are the control panels for the electrical system, into the co-pilot's normal instrument position and have two crew, both in ejection seats, one to fly the aeroplane and the other to operate the electrics. Because we decided we would prefer to have two pilots on it rather than one pilot and a flight engineer or air electronics officer, which is what you really call a man who looks after that side of the thing, we trained one of our pilots to run the electrical side of the aeroplane, and that was Harry Rayner. Another requirement was that the whole trial, when they worked out the program for the whole trial should be run through twice by two separate test pilots to make absolutely sure nothing was going to be hidden or a technique of one pilot might not find something that another pilot might find. So it was decided that Peter Baker and I should do the actual flying of the aeroplane. And throughout the whole trial, we flew alternate flights. If, when it was set on a particular CG condition and this, that, and the other, we would do two flights. I did the first one, he did the second one. Harry Rayner sat in the right-hand seat to run the electrics. And so the whole trial was run with Peter Baker and I flying it alternately. Harry Rayner flew the whole thing, every single flight, in the right-hand seat operating the electrics.
So where do all three of you sit then? You've had two pilots and Harry Rayner.
No, we only had one pilot at a time.
Oh, I see, yeah.
I would do one flight of a trial, and then that flight would be repeated by Pete Baker, and then if we changed C of G or whatever for any reason, I would do the next flight and so on. It was done alternately with myself and Peter Baker in the left-hand seat and Harry Rayner always in the right-hand seat. He did the whole banjax. And the bulk of the work was done at 55,000 feet. And it consisted very largely of investigating buffet boundary turns throughout the CG range of the aeroplane.
What was that, actually taking turns in the aircraft in buffet conditions?
Well, what it meant is what we were actually doing was executing 60-degree bank turns at 55,000 feet, which means pulling 2G, over a speed range which worked up to 0.95 Mach number. And we were able, that aeroplane in those days could do a 60-degree bank turn at 55,000 feet at 0.95 Mach number. And that's going some. And I don't know whether anybody else was doing that then, but we were doing this easily in that aeroplane. And the buffet started at just around 2G. Another interesting thing about this exercise was that the ministry decided that they wanted a chase aeroplane to watch these trials and that we were not to do any actual trials flying without a chase aeroplane in attendance. And before we started the thing, a chap phoned me up from the ministry and said, "Hey, Johnny, we're going to have chase aeroplanes to watch all these trials of yours because if anything terrible happens, we want a witness to see what it is from outside." And what he wanted to know from me was, what aeroplane do you suggest should chase this thing? And I said, well, what do you think? There's only one aeroplane in the jolly world's going to chase it, and that's another one. Oh, he said, we're not going to have two of them praying. So I said, well, what do you suggest? You know, lightnings were around, but I don't know whether they went to 55,000 feet, and there weren't many of them. They were still pretty early days. You couldn't rely on having a lightning every darn time to chase you. In any case, it wasn't going to stay up there for 2 hours, which we were planning on 2 hour sorties each go. Well, the end result was that javelins were chosen, and an RAF squadron was given the task of doing this chase job. And to cover us at 55,000 feet for 2 hours, it took three javelins in relays, because, of course, they didn't have the range or time capability to stay there. And if they didn't overlap precisely, we just had to stop trials until the next one got there.
Could they get up to 55,000?
No, of course not. They got to 48,000 feet, and that's as high as they could go. And they were waddling about at 48,000 feet trying to look up at us. And how much of the time they were actually looking, I mean, it's hard to imagine. And I think, really, the chase side of it was, well, it was a pretty academic situation. I mean, it really wasn't worth its while. But still, it was there and it happened. And it did hold us up sometimes when aeroplanes didn't overlap properly. But they really did a pretty good job. It was only occasional that they didn't actually get an overlap. And they didn't hold us up too much.
Did you have telemetry links in those days?
No, we didn't.
Everything was on your notebook?
Yeah, well, okay. Yes, it wasn't really on notepads. It was on recorders in the aeroplane and any notes we wanted to take if we thought. But, I mean, as the test pilot actually flying the aeroplane, I didn't have a notepad on my knee in those days. So if Harry Rayner would have one, and if I'd said, jot this down, well, then he'd do that. But we have voice recorders. We could record data and so on.
But nothing left the aircraft until you landed.
No, oh no. It all had to come back with us, the whole jolly lot, yes. And, well, the end result of the trial was that we didn't discover anything wrong with the Victor, nor did we discover anything that could have led to the cause of the accident to the first aeroplane. And the Victor came out of it, the Mark II Victor came out of this with a clean bill of health, as I'd always suspected it would. I had no fears about doing this trial at all. I mean, I was perfectly confident that there was nothing wrong with that aeroplane, and there wasn't.
And you did all these trials out of Boscombe, did you?
Oh, no, Radlett.
Oh, Radlett.
Yes. And I can't actually remember this, but if we had some cases where the aeroplane might have been at heavier weights than the Radlett runway LCN allowed, and if that happened, we would then fly over to Bedford and tank up to the amount of fuel required to get the weight up, and then take it from Bedford for the trial, but land back at Radlett, of course, because the weight would have been down by then. But I can't remember whether we did anything for that trial, but certainly for other max or up weight trials, yes, we would zip over to Bedford and fill up with fuel. It was nearer than going to Boscombe. And it's sort of in our part of the world, as it was, rather more.
When the Victor was in service, I mean, was it company policy for you to keep in touch with the squadrons operating it?
Yes, we did keep in touch pretty much. Probably much more than a lot of people would imagine. For instance, from time to time, we had to make routine visits to the squadrons for the purpose of doing emergency drill training and stuff for ourselves as crews. We didn't have the facilities at Radlett, and all those sort of facilities were on the RAF stations, and so to allow us to keep our hand in as far as emergency drills and so on were concerned, we would go to the RAF squadrons for that, and of course that kept a pretty good liaison going anyway. We were always
able to... practicing ejections on the road?
Well, no, we didn't actually do that. It was more four-crew thing and escapes and other emergency drill, system emergencies and that type of thing. They had the simulators, you see. We didn't have simulators. And they had crew training simulators and so on. The first, in 917, the first production Mark I Victor, which was the first one to be ever supersonic, had its nose end turned into a crew trainer for escape drill purposes. For instance, that was the sort of thing that was done, and that was at one of the RAF stations. It moved about depending on where the RAF was keeping victors at any one time.
Did the RAF crews discover anything about the aeroplane that you didn't know and you were surprised to hear about? Or?
No. I don't think during the during any of the Mark 1 days they discovered anything. Well, there is one exception. Yes, I'll talk about that in a minute. That's going back to Mark 1s there, really. But no, really and truly not. But the Mark 2 tanker is a different story because I wasn't involved with the Mark 2 tanker. That happened after Handley Page went out of business. The aeroplanes were modified up at Woodford by Avro's. And whether they discovered anything subsequently on those aeroplanes, I don't know. What I do know is that converting the Mark II into a tanker spoiled it as an aeroplane completely. It just was not what it had been in the bomber role at all. And I did eventually fly one, and I know
how
that.
How different was it?
Well, it had a longitudinal stability problem. This was what was really different about it, to the extent that above 40,000 feet it made it difficult to fly and very difficult for the autopilot to fly. This was not considered serious because in its role as a tanker it didn't need to be higher than that. So it didn't matter, but it wasn't as nice to fly down low. And when I first flew one after conversion, I started a PIO, that's a pilot-induced oscillation, going almost immediately after takeoff. And I'd never, ever had that happen in a Victor before.
What caused that?
Well,
different weight distribution or what?
It was caused because I believe, now I don't want to slang average too much on this, but when, under the Handley Page scheme of things, to convert it to a tanker, we were going to clip off some of the extra wingtip we'd put on it because altitude was no longer such a vital problem. When I say altitude, 40,000 feet became the sort of highest likely altitude rather than 60,000 feet, which was its capability before. To cut off the wingtips, now this shifts the center of pressure, of course, in relation to the C of G. And to overcome this, Handley Page were going to put tip tanks on, which would move the C of G further away again from the center of pressure, and so giving you a sensible couple between the two points on the aeroplane and keep the stability correct. But when Avro's actually did the job, they clipped the wingtips but didn't put the tip tanks on. And so this brought center of pressure and C of G rather close together, and so the aeroplane became touchy. And as a result of that, to try and iron it out, they changed the elevator gearing as well. But it didn't solve the problem. It was still there. And I discovered this instantly when I flew it. Absolutely instantly. Now, having said that, this happened to me because I didn't expect it was going to happen. But having had it happen once, I didn't have it happen again because I was on my guard and I didn't let it happen. But this was the difference. You just wouldn't have had it happen on the bomber version of the aeroplane.
Now, you were going to mention something about the Mark 1 and the...
Well, yes. The one thing that the Air Force did discover that we didn't discover in flight test was the reliability of the nose flaps. The nose flaps were super aerodynamically, but of course they required rather a complicated mechanism to make them work.
Nose flaps.
Well, these are leading edge flaps, if you like.
Yeah.
Yes, they tend to, we call them nose flaps at Handley Page, but they're always called leading edge flaps, of course, these days. Kruger flaps, if you like, but they weren't Kruger flaps, in fact. the difference between the Kruger flaps that most aeroplanes have these days and the things we have. We actually had drooped leading edges, and as opposed to a flap which unfolded from underneath the wing. But in service, they found that they spent rather a lot of time having to service the nose flap actuating systems. And by the rest of the standard maintenance of the aeroplanes, these things took up an inordinate amount of their time. And so they, of course, talked back to Handley Page about this and said, you know, how can you simplify the system that operates them or make it more reliable somehow or another because they're a nuisance? But the aerodynamicists by this time knew a bit more about wing leading edges and so on and thought, crikey, we can perhaps get rid of them altogether. And so they designed a fixed droop leading edge for the wing. And this fixed droop leading edge covered the same span as the leading edge flap. And it was only a very mild droop. When we all heard about this, first of all, we thought, oh, crikey, we're going to have a curly old leading edge to the wing. But it really didn't look too bad at all. And it just extended the wing forward a little bit all along the leading edge where the flaps had been, so that we actually ended up with a notch inboard where the inboard end of the nose flap position. And the droop was very slight. The worry about it mostly was that would it upset performance? Well, when we came to fly the thing, which we did on the Mark 1 initially, we found that it covered all the handling requirements of the aeroplane. It didn't upset the stalling characteristics at all. All of our pre-stall buffet was there, just the same as it had been. But below 120 knots, there was no doubt it wasn't going to be as good as nose flaps, and there was a good possibility of getting into a pitch up and a deep stall situation. But we still had all of our three stages of pre-stall buffet. The warnings were all there and very adequate, and this was all discussed and decided, yes, we can, that's going to be an acceptable situation. When it came to performance measurement, it was hard to detect really any difference in performance at all. It was quite remarkable. And so, with this very successful mod to the wing, and it was the only mod that was ever done really to the wing other than the stretch for the Mark II, nose flaps disappeared gradually. The aeroplanes were all retrofitted to have droop leading edges, both Mark I's and eventually Mark II's. Mark II's started with ordinary operating nose flaps. And so that ironed out an enormous problem for the Air Force. Servicing-wise, there was nothing left to service in that respect. And also, of course, there was some sort of a weight reduction on the aeroplane too. It was all to advantage. That was absolutely superb.
From talking about the aeroplanes, I mean, can you perhaps mention anything more about the people at Handley Page and their characters and the sort of... we talked about the Victor as being a slide rule aeroplane. You'd never even dream of building a modern aeroplane with slide rule inaccuracies now.
No.
The sort of designers and the people you knew at Handley Page, who are the people who stick out in your memory?
Well, of course, the top three on the team were Reginald Stafford, who, when I joined the firm, was technical director, and he was backed up as chief designer Charles Joy, and the chief aerodynamicist was Godfrey Lee, and they were the three main leaders of the whole thing.
Did they go back to planes like the Hamden and far back? Or?
Reginald Stafford, yes, definitely. But Charles Joy, no, because he joined Handley Page, I believe I'm right in saying, during the war, I think from Armstrong Whitworth. And so I believe he'd been an Albemarle man in his day. Godfrey Lee had been with the firm a very long time, but he came from Sanders Row, where he'd been very much of a boat specialist. But it was Godfrey Lee and the aerodynamics team that got the aerodynamics of the thing so right from the beginning. Godfrey Lee was lucky enough to be sent to Germany just after the war ended to look around their factories and talk to their designers, because they were rather well ahead of us on swept wing research and high-speed flight. We were getting there. We weren't sitting back on it, but they just seemed to know a few more things. And so he went there and learnt quite a bit. And it was out of what he learnt that he came up with this idea of having a crescent wing for the Victor. Systems-wise, well, I suppose structures and the rest were Charles Joy. He was in those days a pretty good chief designer, and he kept the whole team together. Under him, electrical man was Peter Cronbach, who was had spent most of his wartime years at the RAE at Farnborough. He'd been at Handley Page before that, but for war service had been directed to the RAE, where he'd been involved with electrical work, and he did the electrical design. He'd done it already for the Hermes, and so by and large the Mark I Victor electrical system was based very much on Hermes electrics. They were only a small team, but they were all jolly good people. And it is amazing, really, to me, that that small team was able to produce that very advanced aeroplane. But they did it, and they did it extraordinarily well.
Because the previous aeroplane they built was the Hastings.
Well, Hastings and Hermes.
And Hermes,
yes.
Yeah.
So the Hermes was the immediate predecessor, because
yes,
it was a bit more advanced. It came after the Hastings and was the civil aeroplane.
Mm.
Yes, and it had a different. It was more advanced systems-wise than the Hastings.
Mm.
Yes.
Did you ever meet the famous Major Cords? Was he still alive in those days?
I never met him, in actual fact. No, he was still alive in those days, but I believe I'm right in saying he was living out in the West Country or South Wales or somewhere or another. I never actually met him, no. I met Volkert, who was chief designer for the firm many years before.
Volkert.
Hmm. He was an Anglo-Swiss who joined Handley Page very, very early on, and I forget what the story goes. His first salary as chief designer, when he was appointed chief designer, his salary was 10 shillings and 6 pence a week or something like that. There's some funny story about that. It's recorded somewhere. It's ridiculous. But he remained chief designer for a long time, was responsible probably very nearly up to Halifax days, perhaps not quite to Halifax, but for a very long time.
What about the boss, Sir Frederick? Did he have a presence all the time?
Yes, he was great. I knew Sir Frederick really a little before I joined the firm, having met him at Boscombe Down at various dining-in nights and things that we used to have there, and one or two of us used to pull his leg rather severely about his aeroplanes, but he took it all in good thing. And when I came to join the firm, I had to go and have an interview with him before I was accepted. And this was almost more forbidding than having an AOC's interview in the Air Force. And I thought, crikey, I've been pulling this man's leg in the mess after dinner at night. I wonder what's going to happen. But in fact, the whole thing went through terribly well, and I was accepted as part of the flight test team and joined the firm.
And was he often around when you landed? And,
no,
briefing, or wasn't he quite that closely involved?
He wasn't, because he was based at Cricklewood, and the flying happened at Radlett, you see, and he might be around if something very special was happening, and certainly if important visitors were coming to see the aeroplane. Yes, he didn't leave it alone. He was always very close to it, especially, I understand, at Cricklewood, where the drawing office people and design people are always on their guard, because he was just liable to walk around at any time of the day, at any day, especially first thing in the morning, to see who wasn't there.
No, I mean, he had engineering qualifications, didn't he? I mean, that's how he started.
He was an electrical engineer, in actual fact, to start with, yes. And when he graduated as an electrical engineer, I forget who the firm was. This is all recorded too. He joined a firm as an electrical engineer, electrical designer, and eventually became chief designer for a short period of time. He was standing in, really, for the chief designer when he decided that he would rather work for himself, and that aeroplanes were the things he wanted to work on. And this must have been around 1905 or just after, I suppose, because he had his first aeroplane flying in 1909.
Incredible.
Yeah. And that was, and he based himself at Barking Creek in those days, but not for terribly long before he moved the whole thing to Cricklewood, into what I believe I'm right in saying were some old riding stables or some sort of stables for horses, which he converted, but that didn't last very long. Otherwise, he quickly moved to another site at Cricklewood, which is where the main factory built up. And they actually had an aerodrome there, of course, for a while, but during Major Cord's day, that was getting to be too small and too difficult, and too much bad weather and smog, and this sort of thing was already happening. And Major Cord's found this space at Radlett, which eventually became
the aerodrome.
The aerodrome from which we operated for the rest of time.
And of course, the chief test pilot when you joined was Hedley Hazeldon.
Yes, Hedley Hazeldon was chief test pilot. Of course, I already knew him pretty well too at Boscombe. He used to be there, obviously, quite a lot, because the first prototype Victor flew from Boscombe, and so he spent a lot of time there, and I got to know him pretty well. When I first got to know him, I didn't have any plans or really thoughts of leaving the Air Force, but I think, as I probably said in the earlier part of it, I suddenly became so interested in test flying and so worried that I wasn't going to get another shot of it by staying in the Air Force, that this is really what prompted me to go looking elsewhere for test flying work. And first of all, in fact, I talked to Bill Pegg, but eventually Hazel, and of course Hazel's work and the projects going on at Radlett were a lot more interesting than those at Bristol at that time.
Mm. And of course you finished up at Hanley Page flying the jet stream.
Yes. When I say I finished up, I finished up flying Victors with Hanley Page, really, because I flew all of, there were 20 odd Mark II Victors standing at Radlett waiting to be converted to tankers, and I flew every one of those up to Woodford. But in between, yes, I did the first flight on the first prototype jet stream, which caused us, in its flight test days, quite a lot of fun. In some cases, it was almost a more difficult aeroplane than the Victor, you might think.
Mm.
Well, particularly its stalling problems. It didn't want to stall conventionally at all, and that sort of an aeroplane with a straight wing should really have approached CL Max, and at about CL Max dropped its nose and stuck it down, speed built up, just like all other aeroplanes are expected to do and are required to do by under civil requirements. But this wretched thing wouldn't do it. Its great thing in life was to drop a wing. And it wasn't predictable it would drop either wing. And it would drop it a lot, like 90 degrees. you could always recover the wretched thing. It was no problem.
After.